I'm the operator with my pocket calculator.
Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOMLP Chapel Hill and Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research, development, and innovation. You can email us at radioinvivo@earthlink.net, and you can access a full archive of our hundreds of past programs over the past 10 years at radioinvivo.net. The Burroughs Welcome Fund is a Golden Voices underwriter here on WCOM and Radio In Vivo. The Burroughs Welcome Fund supports excellence in science education across North Carolina. The fund believes that providing students with engaging and interactive curriculum helps to spark curiosity for careers in science, mathematics, and technology. You can learn about education grant opportunities for North Carolina schools and teachers at www.bwfund.org. It's also a pleasure to acknowledge the underwriting support of Dr. Bob Condor of Carolina Neuropsychological Service of Raleigh and Chapel Hill. Bob provides neurocognitive evaluations and neurofeedback for sports concussions and optimal sports performance. You can learn more about Carolina Neuropsychological Service at carolinacns.com. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by Chapel Hill Eye Care, located at 235 South Elliott Road in Chapel Hill. Chapel Hill Eye Care provides comprehensive eye care to people of all ages. Healthy eyes for a lifetime. Chapel Hill Eye Care, 919-968-4774. And last but not least, Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the Triangle Center for Evolutionary Medicine, or TRISEM, a nonprofit center exploring the intersection of evolutionary science and medicine. TRISEM is jointly operated by Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina Central University. TRISEM is an incubator that promotes innovative developments in the theory and practice of evolutionary medicine by fostering cross-disciplinary collaborations among Triangle-based scholars, physicians, public health workers, and more. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank this terrific group of underwriters for their support. A few weeks ago here on Radio In Vivo, we had the pleasure of speaking to Dr. Fred Gould, who is the co-director of the Genetic Engineering and Society Center at North Carolina State University. Today we close the circle by enjoying the company of Fred's co-director and co-founder of the GES Center, Dr. Jennifer Kuzma. Jennifer is the Goodnight GSK Distinguished Professor in the College of Humanities and Social Sciences and Professor in the School of Public and International Affairs. Her research focuses on governance systems for emerging technologies, particularly genetic engineering for environmental, agricultural, health, and industrial applications. She received her BA from the College of St. Thomas in St. Paul in 1990 and her PhD from the University of Colorado at Boulder in 1995. After serving for 10 years in a variety of positions on the faculty at the University of Minnesota, she joined the NC State faculty in 2013. Jennifer Kuzma, welcome to Radio In Vivo.
Thank you for having me.
To start us out, Jennifer, would you tell us a little bit more in general about your research interests? Obviously, you're not a lab scientist or a clinical practitioner. What role do you play in the scientific research enterprise as a policy professional?
Sure. Well, I started out as a lab professional, in fact, did wet lab biochemistry and molecular biology research. But then from there, I started getting interested in more the broader implications of the technologies that myself and other molecular biologists and biochemists were working on. So I moved to risk analysis, which is a way to kind of integrate toxicological and epidemiological evidence and environmental health evidence, and really where the rubber hits the road in decision-making about how do we govern these kinds of technologies. So I got very interested in more the broader policy and governance aspects through the area of risk analysis then. And then from there, I moved on to a broader look using social science methods and social science theory and policy sciences and policy process ideas to look at how do we best make decisions about emerging technologies in society. And drawing my research really is quite multidisciplinary. So I've published in everything from ethics journals to biochemistry journals to science policy journals, just really all over the place.
I noticed that researching your background, your list of publications, I couldn't quite have put a pin on
exactly.
it.
Exactly. and so I'm quite a bit of a unicorn in this area. But there are a growing number of people like me, because I think there's a greater recognition in society and in academe that problem-solving-based learning and problem-solving-based research is really where it's going. If you think about the global challenges we face, they can't be really addressed by one discipline alone. And so we need a combination of an understanding of social systems, of natural world systems, and policy systems in order to really tackle those problems. And because I had broad interests, I tend to focus very broadly on governance systems, all the way from like the origins of research funding and development to the consumer use and the consumer acceptance or attitudes towards products. Because there are a lot of relationships within those systems and a lot of feedback loops that are very important. And if so, you just look at one particular aspect of those governance systems, sometimes the underlying causes of the problems or of the issues or the opportunities get lost.
And it seems like so often that kind of simplistic approach is the one that kind of takes precedence.
It has. But I'm hopeful that there is a growing recognition that that simplistic approach isn't going to get us to where we want to be. I mean, it's very useful and it's still important to understand very deeply different aspects of those systems, of course. And so we still need that really kind of hardcore disciplinary research. But we also need people that integrate a lot of a variety of disciplines and perspectives in order to tackle these complex problems, for which are embedded in really challenging and complex systems.
Absolutely. Well, Jennifer, when your colleague Fred Gould was here recently, obviously we spent quite a bit of time discussing the National Academy of Sciences Committee report on genetically modified organisms, or GMOs. Mm-hmm. That was a landmark report. And you are currently serving on another NAS committee that will be issuing what will undoubtedly be another landmark report in its own right in December, if it's still anticipated for mm-hmm. December. Mm-hmm. Tell us about, and this is a mouthful name of the committee.
Yeah.
I hope you even have it memorized at this
no,
point.
No, I don't actually, but go ahead.
Okay. It's the Committee on Future Biotechnology Products and Opportunities to Enhance Capabilities of the Biotechnology Regulatory System. Tell us about this committee and what its work is entailing.
Yeah, we tend to shorten the name to the Future of Biotech Committee, which
okay.
is easier to say.
Well, from here on,
we'll
do that.
Yeah, so this committee, it's really interesting because this one is in some respects broader than the GM crops report, but in other respects narrower. So this one is tasked with taking a look at what's coming down the pipeline with respect to biotechnology products. So what's emerging in the near, what I call the near future, mm-hmm. you know, the next 5 to 20 years or so, and doing some horizon scanning of looking at the types of emerging biotechnology products. And that can be anything from new genetically engineered crops to bacteria to animals to synthetic materials that are maybe derived from synthetic biology and really new kind of biochemistry or DNA systems. So it's really a combination of a lot of diversity of products in a lot of different sectors. So it makes it really challenging because we're covering agricultural applications, environmental applications, and consumer products. We're not covering medical applications. That was the one exclusion in the study.
Mm-hmm.
So it's horizon scanning for those types of products. products, and then taking a look at the capabilities of the regulatory system, not from a legal authority perspective, but more from a risk governance or risk analysis perspective. Do we have the tools, the capabilities, the expertise, the methodologies, the processes in order to adequately cover those emerging products that are coming down? So for me, it was a really exciting committee to serve on because a lot of my research has been on how do we anticipate and prepare for emerging products and how do we scan for them and then how do we evaluate them. And this is not so much as to predict, but to prepare for the future because it's very hard to predict the future, but we need to scan that horizon in order to prepare for it.
Absolutely. Well, how and why was this committee established in the first place?
Yeah, and this is one of the ones that was actually called for by the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, the Executive Office of the President. So last July, in July 2015, not 16, there was a memo that the White House released that called for this study, among other things, to take a look at what we call the coordinated framework for the regulation of biotechnology, which has been the system in place since about 1986 in order to oversee the products of biotechnology. And so this memo in 2015 called for an independent external advisory committee from the National Academy of Sciences to go ahead and look at these future products coming down the pipeline. So it was one of those mandated by the White House or asked for. And then the National Academies, as you may have heard from Fred and others, kind of takes an arm's length from the political branches once it has the scope of the study and has negotiated that scope with the sponsor. And the sponsor in this case are the three federal agencies under the coordinated framework that have the primary responsibility for regulating the products of biotechnology.
I see. So where does all this stand as far as deliberations at this point? Is a consensus emerging?
Well, you know, we're not, as committee members, we're not allowed to talk about the deliberations.
Okay.
But I can say that we are on track and working very hard to deliver a report that we hope is useful to policymakers, but also, you know, in some ways innovative to help review these products in the future.
I see. So given these highly classified deliberations at this point, in general, what can you share with us in terms of the what are seen as the likely future products in biotechnology over the next 5 to 10 years?
Right. And so not so much based on the committee's deliberations, but also on my own research, I've seen a lot of interesting things coming down the pipeline over the last several years. And some of the most innovative products that we can envision. I mean, of course, there's ones out there that you can't envision or you try to envision, but then it becomes somewhat more in the realm of science fiction.
Right. 10 years ago, who could have predicted CRISPR and things like that?
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. And that's what's so hard about this. But the exciting ones are, you know, things like the gene editing and the gene drive technologies. So the use of organisms with gene editing machinery in them that can either replace populations or suppress populations. That's gene drive technology. I'm not sure if your audience has heard much about that.
Well, they're about to, because we're going to discuss that in depth.
Yeah, those are really interesting, and I think they create some new questions about genetic engineering in society, because usually genetically engineered products, you want to design them not to spread and to be contained in a sense, or confined at least. Whereas with gene drives, you want to put a few organisms out there that can then mate with the wild population and deliver these genes or these changes to endogenous or existing genes that can then change the population and either cause it to die or maybe protect it from certain diseases. So that's something that's coming down the pipeline and has actually been accomplished in a few laboratory experiments with insects. And so that's one area of emerging products. The other is just, you know, a greater diversity of the types of animals that we're engineering, like the livestock and for genetically engineered animals have been around for a long time, but they're starting to come into the marketplace now with the transgenic salmon that was approved, with the genetically engineered mosquito that was actually approved by the FDA for field trials in Florida. and other diversity of livestock for pharmaceutical production. So there's just a greater diversity on the animal side, I think, that you're going to see. But then there's other things like the microbiomes and engineering of microbiomes by either inserting a few genes or many genes. There's products more of synthetic biology, like highly engineered microbes for biomining or for plant nitrogen fixation. Of course, we've probably heard of de-extinction, so trying to bring back extinct species through a combination of cloning and gene editing and modern molecular biology techniques. And there's several groups trying to work on that. It sounds a bit like science fiction. Sometimes we may laugh at the idea, but actually some serious molecular biologists are working on that issue right now, which is quite interesting. So we have this host of new products coming down, and some might be cell-free systems, like the delivery of gene editing machinery in nanoparticles, for example. So things that are in the environment that aren't exactly living, but have the capability to change genes in populations as well, either upregulate them, mutate them, downregulate them, what have you. So we're going to see living and non-living products that can kind of fundamentally change the operation of living systems in some way that may be beneficial or could be potentially harmful.
Sure. Well, Jennifer, part of the mission of the committee and your mission as well is to enhance capabilities of the biotechnology regulatory system. Now, that's as we've seen already, that's a gigantic kettle of fish,
right,
given where it's been and where it might go in the future. And I know it's been one of your major concerns over the years. So let's dive into all that.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, in your opinion, how have we done up to this point with regulatory oversight of biotechnology?
I think it's been a mixed bag, to be honest with you. I think the coordinated framework that was developed in 1986 and then modified in 1992 was based on existing laws, some of which had been on the books for decades prior to 1986. And the premise of it was to take existing laws and apply them to the products of biotechnology. So in other words, because biotechnology products as a category didn't pose any greater risk than non-biotechnology products in general, no new laws were needed, no new categories of risk, and so the agencies were asked to apply existing laws, like the Pesticide Act, FIFRA, we call it, that was from the 70s, or the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act from the early 1900s, or the Toxic Substances Control Act from the 1970s. And that, in some cases, caused some really kind of strange regulatory hooks, in my opinion, so that agencies trying to fit these new products into these existing laws, in some cases, have caused, over time, some concern about gaps in the system for certain biotech products. But then in other cases, perhaps even redundancies, like too many agencies looking at the same product. So it's been, in general, a mixed bag. Overall, we have not done very well more on the governance side, not so much on the formal mandatory regulation, on collecting data and field data on these products from a post-market setting standpoint. So there is quite a bit of testing, especially for genetically engineered crops that have pesticidal proteins like BT crops. There is quite a lot of pre-market testing through the EPA and its pesticide law.
Mm-hmm.
And there is some post-market monitoring. But for other types of crops that aren't regulated by the EPA, that are regulated just by the Department of Agriculture, there's not any post-market monitoring, really, except an informal kind of monitoring system. So I think we could have done a better job there. I think we could have done a better job of funding risk science, which tends to get lost in between the basic research of NSF funding or NIH funding and the very applied studies that industry submits to regulatory agencies. There's a gap in the middle there that I think we haven't done too good of a job funding. And in many cases, it's been, you know, much less than 1% of overall funding for biotechnology. So I think we could have done much better there. I think we could have done better looking at epidemiological data on food safety. Even though we haven't seen any significant risks from the consumption of genetically engineered crops, some NGOs and consumer groups question whether we've been looking hard enough. So I think we could have done a little bit more there to ensure greater public confidence in the system.
Oh, I see. There's a lot of grist for the mill there.
Yeah.
Do you think, in general, that the industry has been over-regulated through the years, or under-regulated, or inappropriately regulated, mm-hmm. or none of the above?
Well, again, I think it's very product-dependent, because these the coordinated framework is based on taking a look at the type of product to determine which regulatory agency it goes into. So in some cases, for example, BT crops, which have pesticidal proteins engineered into them from the bacteria Bacillus thuringiensis, probably heard of them, but this protein kills certain categories of insects and allows for the reduction of pesticide use in many geographic and farming contexts. That one is probably gone, I think, has had the most rigorous kind of regulatory look. Because it's covered both by the EPA under the Pesticide Act, which has a lot of pre-market data requirements and re-registrations every 5 years or so. And it's also looked at by USDA for plant pest risk. And it's also looked at by the Food and Drug Administration, because it's most of it is going to the food supply or feed supply for animals. So in that case, one might make the argument that the industry has been overregulated recently, once we've collected a mass of data, you know, on the 20 years of the use of these products. In some cases, there's been very little to no regulation, though, on the other hand. I mean, one can take the example of herbicide-tolerant bent grass that has just recently gone through, because it doesn't have any plant pest sequences engineered into it. The USDA doesn't have authority. It doesn't have a pesticide engineered into it, so EPA doesn't have authority. It's not going to food use, so FDA doesn't use its voluntary system to take a look at safety. And it can go to market without any review. And in some cases with grasses, you're going to have, you know, wider pollination and gene flow with other wild relatives, a lot of wild relatives to grasses, and they can become very weedy. And you're going to have a greater resistance to Roundup, the herbicide, and you could have very wide scale use of this. So I think in that case, that's under regulation, and in the BT case, it's perhaps over regulation. Mm-hmm. And so it really is a mixed bag, even in the crop area. And then when you start thinking of microbes and animals, it's very product dependent. However, some of the economic estimates that industry does put out there for how much it costs to go for the regulatory system, when you take a close look at them, many of them are overestimates. Because they include product development costs. Like, they include everything from developing the GM crop, testing it for agronomic performance, looking at the molecular biology of it, which they would want to do anyway as product developers. So there's kind of tricky ways to include, you know, more costs than really are straight up regulatory costs. So it's hard to know what numbers to believe. Mm-hmm. So you can get ranges from anywhere from hundreds of million dollars to submit a crop and get it approved through a regulatory system to like $1 million or $100,000 even. Some academics have said, oh, it only took us a couple hundred thousand to get, you know, this through. So I think it's really a mixed bag.
I see. Well, speaking of mixed bags, you very kindly earlier this week sent me your most recent publication. And I'd mm-hmm. like to spend some time
sure.
talking about that, because it directly speaks to mm-hmm. everything we've been discussing up to this point. And that was a commentary in Science mm-hmm. Where you address many of these questions and really get into the weeds of biotechnology regulatory environment. Which it all stems, as I think you just alluded to, from the 1986
right.
Law called the Coordinated Framework for the Regulation of Biotechnology, or CFRB, mm-hmm. which was and is still comprised of the FDA, EPA, USDA, and the White House. And your paper calls calls for a missed opportunity for U.S. biotechnology regulation. What is this missed opportunity that you refer to?
Sure. Just to clarify, the coordinated framework is a policy document, so not a law, but that's just a confusing point, because what it asked the agencies to do was to use existing laws for developing regulations.
Indeed.
So, but just going back to, we talked a little bit about the memo that was published in 2015, and a lot of us who study the regulatory or oversight system for biotechnology were very excited about this opportunity, because it called for an updating of the coordinated framework and through an interagency process. So FDA, USDA, and USDA have been meeting for the past year and a half or so to kind of look at the coordinated framework very carefully and see what products we are covering, which ones we're not. And so when this memo came out, many of us had anticipated that this would just be a great opportunity to really reconsider how this system is structured.
Sure.
Not only from a risk governance perspective, but also from a public confidence perspective and a public participation perspective, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And so so I had very high hopes for this. And I was like, yes, finally the moment, after studying this for, you know, 20 some years, we're going to finally take a look at this. As that process went along, it became more clear that this was not exactly going to be the reconsideration of the framework that many of us had hoped it would be. But rather it would be a clarification. So at the first public meeting of this process, now this is separate from the National Academy study we've been talking about, just to clarify.
Right. Mm-hmm.
At the first public meeting that the agencies hosted for their interagency process, you know, it was said at the very beginning, we don't anticipate the revision of any authorities or any new authorities. And so that just, you know, lowered our expectations. And it was just this balloon deflating almost of hope that we would reconsider this system.
That's the missed opportunity.
That's the missed opportunity, is that these opportunities come along rarely. And, you know, if you've tracked this issue over time, you've seen it magnify in the press or kind of die down. And in recent years, with the new products coming down the market, especially gene editing and gene drives and synthetic biology, with increased political pressure from the public sphere, with demands for food labeling and also rejection of certain products, there just seemed to be, you know, this perfect opportunity in order to reconsider this system. But it didn't happen, in my opinion. They did, you know, take a close look, and they looked at existing products for which they had clear authorities. but that's not where the problem lied. You know, the problem lies in existing
in the horizon,
and
right.
The horizon for which the authorities are not very clear. I mean, there's even existing products for which the authorities are confusing, like the genetically engineered mosquito is regulated as a new animal drug by the Food and Drug Administration. And if you think about the concerns about that mosquito are going to be largely environmental or ecological.
Mm-hmm.
And the FDA just really doesn't have a whole lot of experience in that area. So it's this weird kind of regulatory hook that they've been using. So even existing products challenge that framework, but they didn't even take a hard look at those. However, they do have a long-term strategy document where they say they're going to be increasing coordination of the agencies and taking a look at some of these issues in the future. But the timing is poor, because the next administration, presidential administration, is we'll see what happens, but they're often likely to throw out what the last administration did on this issue.
Yeah, let alone throw out some of the agencies themselves.
Yes, exactly. So it's kind of, to me, they had a year and a half to do this, and they could have done a more in-depth process. But I do understand they're under a lot of pressures, both legally and politically, and so I do sympathize with the agency staff.
Sure. We, who are typically very, very well-trained and dedicated professionals.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's the one thing, is that, you know, a lot of people beat up on the regulatory system, but all the federal agency staff that I've known working on this issue are extremely knowledgeable and very competent, and try to really do the best job they can within the political constraints and the legal constraints that they are bound by. And therein lies the problem. You know, it's more of a system-wide problem than a individual person or individual agency problem.
Indeed. Well, Jennifer, how would you improve this decision-making process? I mean, what do you think can be done about this? Or is the window of opportunity now closed, or might it reopen at some point in the near future? Given the magic wand, what would you do about this?
Yeah, well, let's assume that the next political administration continues the long-term strategy planning that was set forth by the document that was released just last Friday. Assuming that, there are a lot of models in the social science and policy literature for more engaged and iterative processes to engage stakeholders and interested and affected parties or citizens that are highly attentive or interested in deliberations about emerging governance issues. And so a lot of models have been suggested in the literature and could be tried. And at the very least, I think having an external expert group of not only natural scientists that are molecular biologists, but ecologists, toxicologists, epidemiologists, and most importantly, the ones that are not generally asked for their input, social scientists and policy scientists and ethicists, to help the agencies design a system in conversation with them. Obviously, the agencies can't do everything that external experts ask them to do, but at least to get a slew of policy and system-wide ideas on the table. I think that can also help the agencies in a way, because then you have a wider range of voices that can raise attention to the issue and bring it to Congress, for example, if legal or statutes need to be changed in order to better cover biotechnology. So I think by opening up the process, it might actually do them a service in the long run. It might be a short-term cost, but in the long run, I think it could really increase the legitimacy and the attention to the issue. And then in addition to an expert-like group, you could also have a stakeholder group that would also have input into this process over time. And then also, why not a representative of various citizens who are interested in this issue and have the time to devote to a process like this? So I think by opening, you know, at least in the policy process literature and policy sciences literature, we're starting to understand that by opening up the process, you increase not only the legitimacy of the process, but also the quality of the output by collecting knowledges that you wouldn't necessarily be able to tap into, or ideas that you wouldn't be able to tap into.
Well, it will be interesting to keep an eye on this situation and see where it does go in the short term.
Yeah.
You are listening to Radio In Vivo, and my guest today is Dr. Jennifer Kuzma from North Carolina State University. And Jennifer is a policy expert in all things biotech and genetic. Well, Jennifer, as I mentioned, I did want to spend some of our time together today talking about a subject that I touched on with Fred, but I'd like to hear about more in depth from you. And that is this relatively recently developed biotechnology called gene drives. I know you folks at the GES held a three-day workshop on this very topic back in February. So you guys are at the leading edge of exploring the many ethical, legal, and social implications of gene drive technology. First of all, give us a quick thumbnail of what gene drives are and how they could be beneficial.
Sure. And so I'm sure Fred did quite a good job at explaining this one as well.
Indeed.
This has been his area for, you know, a couple decades.
I mentioned to him, I first heard about this probably, at least 12 or 13 years ago when he did a presentation about
it. Right, right. And so there are some genes that naturally do this, but let me talk about the engineering of gene drives instead. So Fred's been looking at this process, and many people have been looking at this process for over a decade. And now we're starting to call it a different name. And what happens with gene drive technologies is it's really based on a set of technologies that are under the umbrella of gene editing. So there are certain proteins that will cut DNA, and then you can provide a template in order to change the DNA sequence that's already in the organism. So that's called editing. So instead of maybe putting in an entirely new gene, you can somewhat change it. And so gene editing, these gene drives are based on gene editing, but what happens is during meiosis, when you're going to divide up the genes and in the chromosomes, what happens is that these gene drives cut at the location and insert themselves in a way to propagate themselves throughout generations. And so they'll be preferentially inherited. So they kind of overcome Mendelian inheritance. So usually, you know, you'll have 50% of the offspring will receive the gene, 50% will not. But in this case, if during this pairing of chromosomes during meiosis happens and then you copy yourself, then you can virtually ensure that 100% of the offspring will contain the gene of interest. So that gene editing kind of machinery copies itself into the other chromosome, and you overcome the Mendelian inheritance that we often learn about in high school. Mm-hmm. And so in that way, over time, if this system doesn't, you know, decrease the fitness of the organism too much, and Fred does all sorts of models to determine that, you could actually drive this particular gene, so that template that you provided to insert into that spot that was cut, you can actually drive that gene into a population. Now, sometimes that gene that you want to drive into the population can be harmful, and it can be designed to kill the larva in the next generation. So one of the advantages of gene drive technology is that you could potentially release, and again, this is theoretical right now, but you could potentially release very few insects, let's say mosquitoes, down
which
in Florida.
Has been a specialty up to this point, right?
So let's say the genetically engineered mosquito that carries dengue and Zika, Aedes aegypti. Mm-hmm. You could release perhaps a few or a couple thousand of mosquitoes with gene drives systems in them in order to drive down the population, at least in that geographic area where there's interbreeding that occurs. And so you could potentially eliminate that particular mosquito in the area where the interbreeding occurs with. And so that's one advantage, would be to use this to simply remove a species that is harmful to people or to animals. There's avian malaria in Hawaii that's a threat to a lot of native bird species in the Hawaiian Islands. And so that's another example where you could drive down a mosquito population that carries avian malaria to protect a species. So you can protect humans, you can protect, particular species of concern that are threatened or endangered. So there's a lot of talk about doing it for both conservation biology as well as for human health, especially now with the increased prevalence and the concern about Zika.
Sure.
The genetically engineered mosquito that the Food and Drug Administration just approved that for field trials under the new animal drug provisions doesn't technically have a gene drive in it, although it's genetically engineered. That one you have to release millions of mosquitoes continuously, like every so often, in order to keep the population down. It's got an engineered gene for suppression, for killing the next generation, but it doesn't have a gene that'll drive itself and overcome Mendelian inheritance. And so that's the difference there. It's population suppression, but it's not gene drive. So
is that the work that's going on in Brazil at this point?
Yeah, well, that's what they've done in Brazil, mm-hmm. and they've released the Oxitec mosquito. We'll just call it the Oxitec mosquito.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
That's the one that just got approved in Florida, but they've released it already in Brazil, Cayman Islands, Malaysia, Panama. Might be another country I'm missing, but they've released it in several spots across the globe. And the publications coming out of Brazil have shown that it's been pretty effective in reducing the local population of Aedes aegypti. Again, not technically a gene drive, but a population suppression mechanism through genetic engineering. They're very similar outcomes, but different, you know, kinds of technologies. So the idea with gene drives is that you could just release these and the problem would be taken care of. Whereas with the population suppression and the Oxitec mosquitoes, you have to keep releasing a big batch of them every so often to continue to control the population.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, as with so many of these things, there is a substantial potential downside as well. So do you think we have an adequate risk assessment paradigm to evaluate the potential dangers of gene drives?
Yeah.
Big question.
It is a big question. And let's just take the mosquito example for a second, because it's going to be highly dependent on the type of gene drive, its purpose, and what it's being used for, I think, as to what risks are important or perhaps over the threshold so that we should be concerned about them. With the mosquito population, one would think about, you know, the ecological effects, for example, of getting rid of that mosquito and how that might affect the predators that eat that mosquito. You know, how does that affect their food source? So that's one potential risk. Now, Aedes aegypti isn't native, you know, to the U.S., and so who cares if we get rid of it? That's the counter argument to that.
Sure.
But still, some local bird and other populations might have adapted to that as a food source. So we have to think about that carefully. The other issue we might think about is if you remove that particular mosquito, might a different mosquito come in and occupy that niche that carries an even more dangerous or form of dengue or Zika or of some other disease? So kind of that replacement concept. I think that's another thing we have to think about. Now, these are low probability events. But, you know, sometimes when we think of risk, you know, you can still have low probability and a high consequence. And so with some of these new gene drive technologies, you know, generally you're looking at very low probability, but we really don't know what the consequences will be. And I think that's where the major uncertainties lie. As far as taking a good look at those, I think in the academic literature and, you know, think tank literature, in the peer-reviewed literature, there are methodologies that one can use to deal with the uncertainty and the ambiguity and to kind of gain knowledge and data where it may be lacking. So expert elicitation, probability elicitation, fault tree modeling, Bayes' net, you know, things. There are methodologies that we can use. I mean, they're not, nothing is 100% accurate. They're definitely not accurate, but they're the best we have with limited data about an unknown future.
Now, these are modeling.
Yeah, modeling methods, techniques, right? Exactly. Mm-hmm. Where you draw upon the knowledge of systems and maybe not necessarily field experiments. Because if you think about it, you know, if you do a field experiment with gene drive technologies, it's out there.
Right.
So it's very hard to contain. In fact, the purpose would be not to contain it.
Mm-hmm. And it has not been tested outside the laboratory at this point, right?
Correct. Mm-hmm. Correct. So gene drives are still within the laboratory. I should make that clear. Population suppression technology with genetic engineering is not in the laboratory only. It's been released in Brazil and Cayman and those other countries I talked about.
Sure.
So I think we could do better from a modeling standpoint. As far as FDA review of that mosquito, there were, in my opinion, some issues because the FDA New Drug Act, if you call a genetically engineered mosquito for population suppression a new drug, you're essentially looking at the safety to the organism and you're looking at the efficacy of the drug. You're not really looking at the wide-scale ecological impacts. FDA doesn't have authority for that. They can look at them under an act called the National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA. Mm-hmm. So every agency has to look at those ecological effects under NEPA, but their authorities don't lie in the ecology of the organism. So I think there's a little bit of a problem there. The companies do submit data, but often, you know, it's not field data because how can you get field data?
Right.
And so it's really a conundrum. But on the benefit side, in some cases where these technologies, there's a dire need for them, and there's no other options, there might be, you know, the social imperative to use them. to decrease, you know, other harmful options, or to save people from Zika or what have you. So I think you have to look at it from, are we willing to bear some of these low probability, potentially high consequence risks for great health or conservation benefits? And I think that's the question, but that is not strictly a natural science-based question that can be addressed by molecular biologists alone. That's a societal question where we need to bring in other voices. It's not a science-based question, it's a value-based question.
Indeed.
And I think that's where some of my problems lie with just sticking to the natural science and the genetic engineering community in getting policy advice is problematic, because you know, you've got to weigh the risks and benefits, the societal impacts, the cultural impacts, and that's not strictly based on natural science.
Indeed. So. Well, you know, I read that gene drive represents the first time in history that humans have the ability to engineer the genes of a wild population, which the implications mm-hmm. of that mm-hmm. are quite profound. And that
it
brings
is,
up
really.
Really thorny and intense ethical and practical concerns, doesn't it?
Absolutely. What is our place in nature? I mean, how do we value species? It really hits at this kind of bifurcation in the conservation community about whether species are important because they provide environmental services that keep humans healthy, or whether species are intrinsically important and to be protected, you know, as they are. So it's conservation versus kind of preservation in a way. I mean, there is a segment of the conservation community that would be saying that by simply engineering a species in the wild, it is not preserving the species. It's affecting it in some way that it's not the original species. And then also, I've written a little bit about some of the ethical issues. It also might affect our perceptions of nature. So will we view a species that's in the wild, it looks just like a bird, let's say, from Hawaii that was there before, but it's been engineered to be resistant to malaria. Are we going to look at that bird the same way that we looked at the original species? How does that affect our feeling when we're in nature? So there's some of those more intangible, harder to quantify or even talk about, really, mm-hmm. Views of nature that I think this affects. So then on the other side, you know, or do we have an obligation to do this in order to conserve the species? Regardless if we preserve it, do we have an obligation to do it to conserve? So I think there's, you know, at least that bird's still there, even though it's genetically engineered, right?
Right.
So it could be gone, or it could be genetically engineered in there. I mean, ideally, it would be the original, in my opinion. But so, you know, so I think there's arguments on all sides. And that's why this is a societal question, not strictly a science-based question.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Jennifer, another aspect of this gene drive technology that we haven't really touched on is the idea of evolutionary resistance.
Mm-hmm.
I've read that, and I quote, resistance will almost inevitably emerge in standard gene drive systems. How does that happen, and what do you think might be able to be done about it, if anything?
Well, that's a really complicated question, as you know, and your audience probably knows, because resistance usually emerges for everything. I mean, if we put a chemical out there, bugs, you know, microbes or insects for pesticides are going to develop resistance eventually, because evolution is so tricky, you know. Mm-hmm. It's going to overcome it. It's just a matter of time.
Or certainly antibiotics have gotten a lot of attention.
Exactly. Recently. In fact, I just heard on a different radio station on the drive over here about superbugs and antibiotic resistance.
Indeed.
So I think that is a concern. Now, for gene drives, it might be a little bit more tricky because of the molecular biology of the event. And it might not evolve as quickly because of this super Mendelian inheritance. You know, the gene drive could do its job before it evolves resistance. Now, if the gene drive has a fitness disadvantage, though, it's likely that evolution would overcome it. And Fred, you know, would probably tell you that as well. But that's exactly the work that Fred and some others in our program do, is some of this modeling work to look at resistance issues, fitness, and it's really a complicated calculation. And it's complicated to predict. But generally, for many of these, you could probably place your money that resistance is going to evolve. Now, there are some molecular biologists thinking about, well, what if we did it in multiple sites in the genome, like if we had multiple types of gene drives or multiple insertion sites, so that if resistance developed to one insertion site, we'd at least have four or five others where it would still occur.
Sure.
And so there's people thinking about the molecular biology of trying to overcome resistance issues as well. So I think there's some tricks that we might be able to delay it. But, you know, generally, my guess, if I had money, a lot of money to put down, would be that over time it will evolve.
Do you think potentially that resistance could actually be an important natural safety
feature?
Absolutely.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, because, you know, one big issue with gene drives is, okay, so you put something out there, how might you reverse a gene drive that wasn't doing what you intended it to do, or was perhaps creating some other unintended side effect that was undesirable? And so how do you reverse it? And so there's people trying to think about how might you recall a gene drive from the wild. And there's some really interesting kind of like models on paper from groups at MIT, like Kevin Esfelt is one of the kind of conceptual thinkers about reversibility, and then others trying to do it in the lab as well. So that's a good question. How might you reverse it or recall a gene drive? How might you cut it out of the population once you put it in there? And there are ways to
once
do
the
that.
The genie's out of the bottle, right?
Exactly. And there are ways to do that on paper, but whether they can practically work in the field is a good question. But you're right. Resistance could be a very natural mechanism to just let the effects die off. But the question there would be whether or not enough damage has occurred before that resistance evolved. And
sure.
So we still want to develop mechanisms to be able to reverse effects of gene drives when we want to, or recall them when we want to, and complicated molecular biology.
Absolutely. Well, Jennifer, another concept that you've written about related to gene drives is something called intergenerational equity.
Yeah.
Now, what is that, and how does it apply to this gene drive technology?
Yeah, and so my thinking on this has just recently started, but it's one of my favorite new projects. And the history of it evolved from a conversation with my daughter, where I was talking about, she asked me what synthetic biology was. She's an artist, she's a musician, not interested in science at all. I tried to explain it in neutral terms, and she had a reaction that I didn't anticipate, which was, why would anybody want to do that? You know, make these synthetic creatures.
Yeah.
And it made me think that we are not consulting the next generation about what we're doing today with genetic engineering. But we have the ability to, at least, to consult the very next generation. We might not be able to consult five generations down, but we've got these teenagers that are learning about molecular biology and biotechnology in middle school and high school now. And why aren't we asking them about what they desire with their future? Like, what would they think about a population that was engineered out in the wild? Would they want that? Would they think that's desirable? Do they think that we should, use gene drives in order to protect their reproductive health with Zika virus being around right now? And so I've proposed some projects to consult that generation because I think it's important and it's the right thing to do. And there's been a lot of theoretical stuff written on intergenerational equity, but we have an obligation. The idea is we have an obligation today to protect resources and the planet and human well-being for future generations. We're given it for a certain period of time, just like we've received it from subsequent generations. So that's the general idea. But this would be to put it in practice, and it would be to have conversations with teens across the country, but then importantly report those results back to Washington, D.C., to policymakers, and have those teens kind of report back on those conversations. And so we've got a couple draft ideas floating around in that area that I hope to implement. It's really to put intergenerational equity into practice, because we have the ability to do it, and I think we might have the obligation to do it.
I see. Well, that sounds like a very exciting concept,
yeah.
And it'll be another thing that'll be fun to watch going forward.
Thank you.
Well, Jennifer, the hour has just flown by on
it
us,
has.
And I want to thank you for joining me today on Radio in Vivo. Keep up all the great work going on at the GES Center, and we desperately need answers to some of these questions we've been discussing about genetic engineering and society.
Thank you for having me.
We've got some great guests lined up in the coming weeks here on Radio in Vivo. You can check the website, radioinvivo.net, for our lineup of upcoming shows. Join us again next time for Radio in Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM-FM, Carrboro, and Chapel Hill. Now be sure to stay tuned for one of our most popular shows on the WCOM schedule, The Courage Cocktail with Leanne McClymont. Thanks for listening, and we will catch you next time.